Well, as we're all keenly aware, perhaps the greatest blessing of the covenant of Baha'u'llah is his gift to his community and to mankind in due course of an infallibly guided leadership, the guardianship, and the Universal House of Justice, functioning successively as head of the faith. And as an evolutionary process unfolds under the guidance of the head of the faith, it creates for us who are so attached to our own particular conception of the cause at any given stage, it creates for us a successive series of tests. And these tests free us from our unexamined preconceptions about what Baha'u'llah really means and so on. Because after all, we're fallible human beings. We have very limited experience at the best of times. And we create, having read the teachings and seeing the example of the friends around us and trying to follow the guidance of the head of the faith, we create our understanding at any given point. And constantly we have to go through a process of setting some of these cherished assumptions aside, because whole new dimensions of the faith open up for us. And that's the nature of reality. The nature of reality is that it is constantly unfolding to minds that are, by their very nature, limited. Well, I think it may help our discussion of this highly theoretical subject if we take a look at least one stage of the process that brought us where we are right now. And this happens to be a very critical stage. I'm thinking of the first half of the 20th century. And to do that, it's helpful to start off by, to the best of our ability anyway, trying to get a sense of the Baha'i community that existed before the guardianship, during the ministry of Abdu'l-Bahá. The community that the guardian inherited, you could say, from Abdu'l-Bahá. And it's very difficult for us to do this because that community was so different than from anything that we know today. It was, you could call it an arena for free-ranging speculation. Baha'is enthusiastically were given over to belief in spiritualism, in various forms of theosophy, in astrology, handwriting, the reading of handwriting, the reading of dreams, and so on. And I won't go into details, but there were some very prominent Baha'is who gave courses in this kind of thing, or told you what your aura was, and then gave you a name for that would be in harmony with your particular aura. It would have been impossible, most certainly, had there been any impulse toward the creation of an international convention to regularize what Baha'i beliefs were. It would have been possible to arrive at any rational perception at all of this nature, because all of these things were contradictory. People, indeed, the individuals held up views that were completely contradictory one to another, to say nothing of the contradictions that separated different views in community and entertained people, no doubt, because it was all basically quite harmless. It was harmless because the Baha'i faith was Abdu'l-Bahá, and the Baha'is didn't need something else. It's little wonder that many of them felt that the Abdu'l-Bahá was the return of Christ. It gave him great difficulty in trying to explain to them that that was not the case, and the guardian had to pick that challenge up later on. But it's little wonder that they felt like that because of this immensely appealing figure. The very embodiment of spiritual reality to anybody who came in contact with him, even his letters, even a few lines from a letter. There are many stories about this. His letters, the pilgrimages people paid to Haifa, the pilgrims' reports then, which were actually published and widely diffused, Abdu'l-Bahá's own travels, and the tireless love and encouragement that he showered on everybody. You know, we all are familiar with these stories of after he had given talks and then staying up until 2 o'clock in the morning with a series of people still waiting to talk to him about their own particular spiritual search. He created, his very existence created an intimacy with God that was totally satisfying to the spiritual desires and needs of the Baha'i community in all its diversity. And then with the passing of the heroic age, the apostolic age, his own death in 1921, the guardianship emerged. And suddenly there was, really in very short order, despite the gentleness that the guardian applied to his own communications, there was a revolutionary change in what people understood the Baha'i cause consisted of and what it required. There was for those who went on pilgrimage, there was a focus now not on the guardian. He refused that. There was a focus now on the shrines. The authority on which communities functioned was not some individual who might have a particularly strong personality or so on, but an administrative order with local assemblies, and people had to get used to the idea that when an assembly made a decision, this was the authority that should be accepted by the community. There were laws. I mean, everybody had understood for a long time that Baha'u'llah and the Akdas itself discouraged the use of alcohol and drugs and so on, but the Guardian made this a requirement of being a Baha'i who could be satisfied that he really was acting in accordance with the will of Baha'u'llah. He called on Baha'is to leave their churches and synagogues, because up until that time, that was not a particularly important issue in a religion which emphasized very strongly its acceptance of all religions. You could easily mix up a particular church or sect or denomination with what Baha'u'llah meant when he was speaking about religion. Baha'is were required to stop involvement in political activities, withdraw from political parties and so on. Probably one of the most dramatic changes was the sudden introduction of a series of plans under the guardianship, two plans and then the 10-year crusade, so that things were done collectively and systematically. All of this was a very different world, and I think we have to try and understand our Baha'i predecessors, the challenge this must have represented for them. Possibly the greatest of all the challenges was the one the Guardian laid before them at a very relatively early stage when he called on them to, in his words, vindicate the independent character of the Baha'i faith as an independent world religion. Well, how was it going to happen? I mean, how could a community of the kind that I've described, how could they possibly conceive that they were able to establish their body of beliefs as a religion on the same level, which is what the Guardian was calling for, as Judaism, Christianity, Islam, which had existed for centuries or millennia? The Guardian set them off on that. He provided the leadership. He, for example, when the a Sunni Muslim court in Egypt deprived three Baha'i men of their wives because the wives were supposedly Muslim, the court said that no, the Baha'i faith was not Islamic, it was not a sect of Islam, it was a completely separate religion, and therefore these divorces were endorsed. Well, naturally, the Baha'i community was distressed, to say nothing of the husbands, one assumes. But the Guardian said, no, look at this in the long term. We have been, the independent character of the faith has been attested to by an accepted Muslim ecclesiastical court. And that court decision has been quoted many, many times in the years since then. Certainly, I'm sure, to the horror of the mullahs who were involved in it, who are now in the next world and able to observe what actually was going on in Baghdad. Shia Muslims had seized the most holy house, the center of Baha'i pilgrimage. And the government refused, really. It broke its own promise to the League of Nations that it would cause the Shias to give the house back to the Baha'is. The Baha'i community was greatly distressed. The Guardian said, stop and think. Our case has been taken up by the highest civil authority that humanity in 6,000 years has ever managed to create. It has taken it up, it has taken it very seriously, it has studied it, and it is found in favor of the Baha'is. We are the aggrieved and wronged parties. And it has made a judgment, the fact that the judgment has been ignored by those who misbehaved in this fashion doesn't change the significance of what has happened. He called for Baha'i marriage to be recognized. That meant fundamental changes in many jurisdictions, because marriage has been conducted by priests and rabbis and ministers and so on. Now suddenly laws were going to have to be adjusted to accept the decisions of collective bodies, namely local spiritual assemblies who would perform these marriages. He called for Baha'is to ask for, holiday leave on Baha'i holy days, so that that particular Baha'i institution would be recognized in consequence, and the same thing in the schools. Baha'is themselves got into the spirit of the whole thing, and we created something called World Religion Day, which had never existed before, the third Sunday of January. And to our surprise, this was very warmly received by many other elements in society. People loved the idea of a World Religion Day where you'd get a rabbi and a priest and a minister and some oriental dignitary and a Baha'i together to talk about the oneness of religion. We began very nervously, but insistently, under the Guardian's guidance, to urge the inclusion of Baha'i readings in elementary and high school curricula, and the same thing at a higher level in university, this creation of materials that could be used for courses in comparative religion. The Guardian, acting through one of the National Assemblies, enlisted the support of various prominent personalities who attested to the independence of the cause. The one that occurs to me is Arnold Toynbee, the world's probably leading authority at that time on comparative religion, who agreed to write under his own signature to the government of Turkey, I think it was, explaining in his words that the Baha'i faith was an independent religion to stand on the same level as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. A tremendous coup. And of course the fact, our own education. We ourselves had to be educated to see the Baha'i faith in this way, rather than in some narrow personalized view of it that we might have otherwise have developed for ourselves, and the temples and so on. All of this effort, this highly complex effort that influenced so many different areas of human life, eventually produced the total success of the mission that the Guardian had assigned. For myself, the whole thing came into sharpest focus, I'll never forget. I think it was in the late 1980s. For reasons that we didn't understand, the Vatican had invited the Baha'i World Center to send representatives to discuss with it, in its words, the formalization of relationships, institutional relationships between the Vatican and the Baha'i World Center. And so I was very privileged to be one of the representatives. Secretary of the Italian NSA was the other one. And we went to this beautiful palazzo just on the at the entrance to St. Peter's Square to meet a cardinal and an archbishop who were the representatives of the leaders of the particular department of the Vatican that dealt with interfaith affairs of various kinds. Before they ever came into the room, we noticed that in this large reception room was a great display with a huge circle in the center and multicolored, and around the circle were 9 smaller circles. And each one of these smaller circles, which was a different color from the others, had a symbol in it that was the Star of David and the cross and the crescent. And then we realized the violet-colored circle up in the top left-hand corner, I still remember it, had a 9-pointed star. We rushed over to the exhibition, and we saw that the central circle was the calendar of the year, 365 days of the year. And so we immediately looked for the violet-colored rays, and sure enough, there was Nowruz and Rizwan and the martyrdom of the Bab and the birth of Baha'u'llah and so on. Well, this was incredible. The meeting turned out to be pointless, completely pointless. I don't recall the details of the discussion we had, which led nowhere, and in any event, it didn't matter. Because here, at the heart of Christianity, the guardians call for the vindication of the independence character of the Baha'i Faith. They've been fully achieved. This recognition, you couldn't have asked, sort of like the cherry on the top, I suppose you could say, of the sundae. And now, it's no longer in question. The independent character of the faith as a world religion is not in serious question any place in a part of any part of the civilized world. I use civilized in a general sense of countries and societies that are not dominated by some ideology or private theology. Now, what does all this mean? What it means is that the Baha'i community, because many of the Baha'is in the Baha'i community under the leadership of the Guardian were naturally people who had been Baha'is maybe all their lives, and certainly many of them during the ministry of Abdu'l-Bahá. The transformation and the experience of the Baha'i faith by the Baha'i, on the part of the Baha'is themselves, is staggering to contemplate. The idea that you have a faith that is seen by everybody else as a cult, along with all kinds of other cults, and gradually and systematically and with tremendous success, it has burst that those limitations and become an independent world religion, functioning as all of the other world religions. And even though it is only a few years old compared with, in historic time, compared with these other ones. One reflection, I suppose, that immediately comes to mind is that it had become impossible for Baha'is to think themselves back into the Baha'i faith that they had originally been members of, or that perhaps that their parents had talked about, that they may have been raised in. That faith in the period of Abdu'l-Bahá's ministry had vanished into history where it belongs, and an entirely different conception of the Baha'i faith had emerged that called on the Baha'is to be far more audacious, far more confident, far more creative than anything that they could have imagined in the past. Well, this is one period, one hugely important period, obviously, in the evolution of the cause. But the process doesn't end there. The process is going to go on throughout the whole history of the cause in the future. Already, even at this point, at the beginning of this new century, the cause, under the guidance of the Universal House of Justice, has moved into, I can think of at least 2 major stages, I guess you could call them, which required us to stretch our imaginations in ways we had never conceived of doing before. With the emergence of the House of Justice itself, with the tremendous triumphs that we enjoyed during the last decade of the 20th century, when the United Nations focused on basically Baha'u'llah's teachings. But now we are right now moving into an enormously demanding new stage, a stage that will test us to our very limits, and that will be immensely exciting and fulfilling for all of us who embrace it.